This is The Best of Our Knowledge, a presentation of National Productions.
Remember when you got your first computer and had to make up your very first password? Well, that was your introduction to the world of cybersecurity. That world has gotten a lot larger.
When the internet was developed, it was never imagined that computers would have such power.
Today on The Best of Our Knowledge, we'll talk to a Homeland Security official about cybersecurity in and out of school. We'll also hear about New York State's transgender bathroom policy, or lack thereof, find out if the water in the state schools is safe to drink, and spend an academic minute longing for your cell phone. I'm Bob Barrett, and this is The Best of Our Knowledge. Twenty years ago or so, the term cybersecurity didn't exist. Now it's one of the fastest growing job opportunities in the country. It also has its own government subdepartment. Dr. Phyllis Schneck is Deputy Undersecretary of Cybersecurity for the U.S. Department of Homeland Security. We sat down to talk about cybersecurity, and I asked her if someone fell asleep 20 years ago and just woke up, how would she define cybersecurity while feeding this person coffee?
Protecting the communications among all of our different ways of life, from electricity to water to banking to our cell phones. Everything has a computer in it. Everything is connected. We have to make sure that it's safe.
You have been at this from both the private sector and the public sector now. What are the differences between those two approaches, and is one better than the other?
The private sector is focused on building and innovating great products and services. To do that, they need money. So they have to make money, so they constantly follow a bottom line. It's a classic business model. The government is focused on securing enough money to be able to do a mission. And our mission, in my case, is to lead the team of 2,000 fine scientists who are responsible to protect and mitigate cyber risk, to protect from cyber threat, and to respond to cyber threat across federal civilian government and the private sector, to include academia.
You're talking about an awful lot of people with an awful lot of jobs. What does that really involve?
Well, in our team, it's anyone from people that can dissect a computer program and understand what it tried to do or is going to do, to the people that can build trust with our stakeholders, companies that might be willing to share information about what they see as cyber threats. And the department takes a very strong role in protecting privacy and civil liberties. So working with lawyers and privacy advocates and trade associations and civil liberties advocates, because ironically, our way of life that we strive so hard to protect could be changed and sacrificed if we don't protect the very privacy and civil liberties that underpin it. So it's an integration of privacy and security. It's a collection of cyber threat indicators, if you will, which are authorities that were given to our operations center by Congress to make sure that we can put data together, preserving the equities of our citizens, fellow agencies, companies, and distributing data out to the different parts of our network to make it smarter so that we can work like your body's immune system and stop bad things or see bad things before they happen. And both private sector and government have huge roles in that. It's symbiotic. My stance on this has always been that government should buy more than we build. We should let the private sector innovate and make money on that innovation, because what happens with that profit is it goes back into more innovation. What we and DHS do uniquely is we can coordinate and put data together and put products together along with unique services to government and put that together and be stronger together.
Is that always symbiotic? Is there ever an adversarial relationship between the two?
Of course there is, because we have different equities. And part of, I think, the beauty of my team is that we work hard to build trust with industry so that when issues come up where each side has a different way of looking at it or a conflicting way of looking at it, we can work through that and do the right thing for our country and our citizens. And I will add there's an international component to that. Many of our large companies do sales and manufacturing overseas in large numbers. We want to make sure that we make policy and create operations that protect their operations and don't jeopardize the business side, because, again, we're in business to protect our way of life, and that's a large part of it.
Is there ever going to be a time where we can say, oh, we got this now, or is this always going to be a moving target?
It's a lot like biology. It's always a moving target. But we started from a place that I consider far behind, because when the internet was developed, it was never imagined that computers would have such power So they can compute so fast and create such data so quickly. That's what enables your iPhone to render your pictures so fast. You can just send it out. That's what renders evil software the ability to propagate so quickly. No one ever imagined that the connectivity would create a bad side. So now we're catching up. We have legacy systems we have to figure out how to either replace or protect. That's expensive. But going forward, not only are we concurrently working on protecting what we have, but going forward, really unleashing the power of young minds, diverse minds, student bodies all through the country. Let's build new technology that is as secure as it is hot, and let's change as we go forward to make things so that they are designed to be more resilient. If someone tries to attack you, much like your human body's immune system, you will attack back naturally.
Is a lot of that innovation coming from institutes of learning?
Absolutely. There is a lot of good research happening all over the country. There are many cities all over the country. As you know, DHS has a small office in Silicon Valley that combines our regional presence from a National Protection and Programs Directorate and Infrastructure Protection with someone that is driving operations for that office, with folks from other parts of the department that lead the Silicon Valley effort. We drive cyber operations. We have a regional presence. It's good use of taxpayer money to take our presence in one area of the country and put them together. When people work together, even from parts of a department that's as big as ours, great things happen. And there are so many other cities and areas of our country that would, by their local culture, lend diverse perspectives to this massive mission of Homeland Security and specifically cybersecurity. And working with our university, our academic presence, and our military, the future looks good.
Universities, of course, have cybersecurity programs. What about high schools? What about grade schools? Is it getting down that far?
It is getting down that far in some places. It's all different. It depends on the high school. In some cases, it depends on the teachers. Some grade schools are showing this to younger kids. I think, it's in my opinion, younger kids have a better mastery of some of the new technologies than some adults. And so it's even more important to show them the issues in keeping themselves safe and their devices safe. And it's really a parental role, as with everything else as well. We have to build this into a culture. It's not just a hoodie in a dark room with a pizza anymore. This has to get as built into our culture as fashion in Hollywood. And make sure, even if we leverage those things, which people embrace and enjoy, if we leverage those things to put a culture of understanding connectivity for the goodness it brings, and the danger it can bring if not used correctly is important, and I believe that's part of our next steps as a culture.
Is teaching young kids cybersecurity going to be the next don't take candy from strangers?
I think it already is. My young nieces are taught that every day by auntie and their mother. But I truly believe that it will be part of the culture. It will be part of the schools, because more and more you see school systems using computers as a tool to teach. And what they're doing in many cases is obviously keeping those networks off the internet. But they're also teaching the kids about passwords, and they're also teaching the kids not to click on random links. And often, most importantly, they're teaching the kids, when you get a message from someone on a little device, you don't talk to people you don't know. So we're all taught not to talk to strangers. Don't talk to strangers online.
What are the biggest cyber goofs that private people or businesses make?
So a personal opinion, is putting too much personal information on the internet. Because once something is put out, it can't be taken back. And really having an understanding when you use the internet that you are connected worldwide. And it's your responsibility to protect your device, to make sure that somebody that would steal your information is not electronically present on your device or on the device of the entity or person with whom you're communicating. And overall, to treat any new technology as you would treat any new medicine or anything else new in life, with care and with caution, and to understand how things work before you use them.
Still to come, what our conversation with Dr. Phyllis Schneck, Deputy Undersecretary of Cybersecurity for the U.S. Department of Homeland Security, continues. We'll talk about some cybersecurity students that she met while touring a Florida university. That's next on The Best of Our Knowledge. Got any questions or comments about The Best of Our Knowledge? Send them in. Our email address is knowledge@wamc.org. And if you'd like to listen to this or any past programs again, you can find them online at our flagship station's website, Just go to WAMC.org and click on the programs link. And while you're there, subscribe to the Best of Our Knowledge's podcast or download the WAMC radio app to listen on demand anytime, anyplace. This is the Best of Our Knowledge. I'm Bob Barrett. Our guest today is Dr. Phyllis Schneck, Deputy Undersecretary of Cybersecurity for the U.S. Department of Homeland Security. I spoke to her as she toured the University of West Florida in Pensacola. And full disclosure, that's where this program is produced. I asked her about the cybersecurity program and the students she spoke to on her tour.
Today I had the opportunity to meet some amazing students who are ahead of their time. They are exactly what we're looking for as far as not only being smart and having mastered their part of the field so young and really working toward what can they do next with that degree, what's the research they want to do, what are the ideas they're interested in. Every student with whom I had the opportunity to talk, and there were many, had a direction that they personally loved, had a set of faculty that they had worked with and guided them through this. But more important than that, these students can communicate. So again, they're not hoodies in a dark room that are introverts, although that is a demographic that, of course, will always be part of cybersecurity and likely anything technical and in any field, and that's great. But we also need people that enjoy communicating outside. They talked a little bit about their team projects and how that was a new experience. That's a valuable experience that the faculty is giving them, because when you come out to the workforce, in industry or government, you have to be able to play with others in the zoo, or else you won't be able to communicate and get your ideas across, or even more importantly, learn from anybody else.
Does DHS do any work trying to bring people over from the dark side?
Absolutely. And some of my best friends fit that demographic. But we also want to make sure that the department is reaching all demographics, both genders. As I was explaining to a group earlier, the adversary is fairly diverse. And what diversity brings you is different perspectives. You don't even realize it, but when you take people that are different and put them together to solve a problem, your problem gets 1,000 points of light. Your solution is presented better because it has all those different angles incorporated into it. And that's the rock star team I want. And it is hard to go out and try to find all those different people because sometimes they aren't the ones that have the opportunities to come to us. So we are making every effort we can. I think this administration has made gargantuan efforts to bring all different walks of life and certainly make opportunities for women in technology to reach out to younger students. And to bless, I mean, our leadership, our secretary, is very much in favor of our finding the best and brightest and top talent from all over the country to come help with our mission.
How many passwords do you have and how do you remember them?
I have too many. I'm fairly decent about changing them. The way I remember them is I write down a hint to myself about what they are. I have found that that's because if you have it stored electronically and the battery's dead, you're done. Mm. So what I do is I write myself a hint, and the passwords are fairly obscure, and I know what that hint is. So if somebody found that piece of paper, it's worthless to them. But at least I have a record that's fairly easy for me to have them all. I think it's important to know that cybersecurity is exciting. It's not just a field for the nerds or for the scientists. It's not just a government thing. This is our future, the ability to create and manufacture technology that recognizes malicious activity, that does not need to be secured after the fact. You're on the cutting edge. We're in this business not to secure machines, but to secure a way of life. No one cares about a machine. You care about the data that's on it or what the machine does. And in the end, I want people to be able to enjoy new technology. So we talk now about understand what it can do and the dangers it has, the vulnerabilities it has. That's because that technology was not designed with any safety mechanism for cyber. Going forward, I want people to enjoy and embrace new technology and for the vulnerabilities to be the unique part and to have our best brains on the most egregious threats and to remove the noise that we're seeing now. And with the right people and the speed of computing, that's exactly what we're doing.
Dr. Phyllis Schneck is Deputy Undersecretary of Cybersecurity for the U.S. Department of Homeland Security. Many school districts are working to draft a transgender policy to protect a student's rights. The transgender issue affects not only students in K through 12, but also colleges and universities. From station WBFO in Buffalo, New York, Eileen Buckley says there is no one set policy in place for schools to follow.
A few weeks ago, President Obama issued a directive to public schools across the U.S. saying transgender students should use a bathroom or locker room in which they identify with.
I think some districts are absolutely struggling with this situation. They want to make sure that individuals, students, are 100% protected from any type of discrimination, while at the same time balancing the concerns that some individuals in their community have with regard to just these differences.
Tracy Lepardi is an attorney at Harris Beach in Buffalo. She specializes in education law. The debate continues over transgender students' rights in a school. Lepardi says the Obama directive was issued in a joint letter from the Department of Justice and Department of Education.
And that guidance, while it doesn't have the same force of law, that certainly is something that various educational institutions need to consider, because otherwise they could potentially lose federal funding. We've seen some lawsuits around the country, but certainly the Department of Justice becoming involved with various schools and telling them that they must provide appropriate facilities to transgender individuals, otherwise they will lose federal funding.
But almost a year ago here in New York, the State Education Department did issue a transgender and gender nonconforming students' guidance document to assist districts with their policies.
So this is very personal for me as a gay woman who 30 years ago, if I talked about being a lesbian, there would be the same kind of issues and fright that's going on right now about transgender kids.
Randy Weingarten is president of the American Federation of Teachers. Weingarten says it is about the safety and security of transgender students.
They have to be safe emotionally. They have to be safe physically. And that the places where we've had bathrooms that accommodate non-conforming gender issues or accommodate kids who are transgendered, there's not been any safety issues there. That's actually been better for everyone involved.
Weingartner says she was recently involved in an op-ed piece in Delaware where they've changed the policy to make sure transgender students are comfortable in locker rooms and bathrooms.
It's actually been helpful. It's actually been less, there's been fewer issues, not more issues. And I think those policies are good. Those policies are important in terms of inclusiveness, but most important, those policies are important in terms of safety and security of children.
But those who oppose a transgender person using a locker room or bathroom of their choice believe that there could be potential danger for other students. For students in kindergarten through 12th grade, they are protected in New York State under the Dignity for All Students Act. That's designed to provide a safe and supportive environment without discrimination or bullying. Colleges and universities follow federal guidelines.
I think one of the other difficulties, too, is that school districts also have to maintain the privacy for students under the Federal Family Rights and Privacy Act. In that regard, these types of decisions and these types of circumstances pertaining to students are, and they should be, very much on a case-by-case basis.
Back in January, the Clarence School District approved a policy, but before the vote, both parents and students spoke out for and against the issue. The Buffalo Public School District is calling the president's directive welcome news. The district is working on developing its own policy to enhance protections and support students. Lepardi says while districts must remain cognizant of the law and interpretations, the most important aspect is to make sure adults are listening to students.
That report from Eileen Buckley in Buffalo, New York. Nobody will be using the bathroom at all if there's contamination in the water. Clean water advocates in New York State have set their sights on keeping lead out of school drinking water. A coalition of New York public health, environment, and healthy schools advocacy groups have banded together as they push state government leaders to take action. The Best of Our Knowledge's Dave Lucas reports.
The New York State Department of Health says primary prevention, taking deliberate measures to prevent exposure to lead before it occurs, is the only effective way to protect children and families from lead poisoning. Jackie Cohen is the senior legislative associate at the New York Public Interest Research Group. She says lead particularly threatens children as their bodies absorb the neurotoxin more rapidly than adults, leading to learning disabilities, lower IQ, developmental and behavioral issues.
What we're finding is that there are elevated lead levels in schools across New York State. Recently, in New York alone, school districts in Ithaca, Binghamton, and now New Rochelle have been forced to close off taps, close down drinking fountains and sinks because they found elevated levels of lead in their drinking supply. Groups like NYPIRG and other advocates are calling for measures by the state legislature to ensure no student has to continue drinking contaminated poisoned water.
Currently, there is no EPA mandate that schools test for lead at the tap. Health advocates want all water taps at schools across New York tested. Claire Barnett, executive director of Healthy Schools Network, says they've laid out a 5-point plan. Mandate that all schools test their water for lead and copper contamination at the tap.
If you don't test, you won't find. You know, you really do have to look, and it's important to look.
Provide safe drinking water if elevated lead levels are in school drinking and cooking water. Tell test results to parents and teachers quickly.
Parents out there who may be slightly alarmed, we urge you to ask to see the lead test and thank your school for doing the testing and thank them for sharing the results.
Establish a source of funding to pay for remediation such as filters or new pipes and make available an annual report from school water testing by the State Department of Health.
Schools that are on municipal systems, public water supplies, really aren't required to test at the tap for contaminants. But it is schools that are on private well water across the state and across the country are required to test at the tap for lead and copper and other contaminants.
Those test results can be accessed through the U.S. EPA website by typing in your zip code. Reporting for the Best of Our Knowledge, I'm Dave Lucas.
Are you holding your smartphone now? You know you really want to. That's the topic of today's Academic Minute.
Everyone has a smartphone these days, but the media is still looking for the best way to reach them. I'm Dr. Lynn Pascarella, president of Mount Holyoke College, and today on the Academic Minute, Sylvia Chan Olmsted, professor in the Department of Telecommunication at the University of Florida, determines that bite-sized amounts of information may be the best way to hook readers.
We all know that Americans have a love affair with their smartphones. A recent report showed that 38% of American smartphone owners never disconnect from their devices, and over 71% of them sleep with their phones. As these devices become a necessity, the media industry is trying to figure out how to best integrate all these media platforms to deliver the best impact. With that in mind, my recent study focused on examining the relationship between smartphone dependency and a consumer's media consumption patterns and perceptions. Surveying young millennials, we found that, first, there is a strong relationship between a young adult's dependency on smartphones and his or her dependency on computer and television. But that's not the case for radio or print dependency. Young adults who are heavier users of multiple platforms tend to have stronger smartphone dependency, and the mobile device typically serves as the main platform they use. Gender, race, and even consumer innovativeness do not play any role in smartphone dependency. We also found that the mobile functions that are most relevant to smartphone dependency for young millennials were those associated with social networking, communication, and mobile-specific tasks such as location-based applications, but not content. The value of smartphone for media consumption appears to rest more on its social and mobility characteristics and less on its potential as a content platform. Knowing the importance of social functions on mobile platforms, our next project is to look at how more bite-sized content as opposed to long stories might be integrated into social media on these devices.
That was Sylvia Chan Olmsted of the University of Florida.
The Academic Minute is a production of WAMC, Northeast Public Radio, in partnership with Mount Holyoke College. That's all the time we have for this week's program. If you'd like to listen again, join us online at our flagship station's website. Go to WAMC.org and click on the programs link. While you're there, subscribe to the Best of Our Knowledge's podcast or any of the other national productions podcasts. And if you have any questions or comments about the program, send them in. Our email address is knowledge@WAMC.org. I'm Bob Barrett. Be sure to join us next time for another edition of the Best of Our Knowledge.
Bob Barrett is producer of The Best of Our Knowledge. Dr. Alan Chartok is executive producer. The Best of Our Knowledge is a production of WAMC Radio's National Productions, which is solely responsible for its content. Hear more at WAMC.org.